Bien, je vous propose de commencer le séminaire. Nous avons un tout petit peu de retard parce que nous avons aujourd'hui une équipe de la télévision Arte qui prépare un documentaire sur la lecture et le cerveau. Mais c'est un grand plaisir pour moi d'introduire l'exposé d'aujourd'hui. Pourquoi lisons-nous ? Qu'est-ce qui nous attire exactement dans la littérature et comment expliquer que nous éprouvions d'aussi intenses émotions à parcourir des livres qui ne sont après tout que des petits tas de feuilles sèches, selon l'expression de Jean-Paul Sartre. Et au-delà des livres, existe-t-il une prédisposition humaine plus générale pour la fiction, que ce soit à l'écrit, à l'oral, dans les films, à la télévision, au théâtre ? Le besoin de raconter des histoires est-il universel dans l'espèce humaine ? Est-il issu de notre évolution ? Nous confère-t-il un éventuel avantage sélectif ? Participe-t-il à notre éducation? Aiguise-t-il nos facultés cognitives, nos facultés sociales? C'est pour tenter de répondre à quelques-unes de ces questions que j'ai le grand plaisir aujourd'hui d'introduire le professeur Brian Boyd, qui est University Distinguished Professor au département de langue anglaise de l'Université d'Auckland et qui a été invité par l'Assemblée des professeurs du Collège de France à donner deux conférences sur ma proposition ainsi que celle d'Antoine Compagnon, qui est ici titulaire de la chaire de littérature française moderne et contemporaine. Le professeur Boyd est internationalement reconnu comme l'un des plus grands spécialistes de la vie et de l'œuvre de Vladimir Nabokov. Dès sa thèse, soutenue en 1979 à l'Université de Toronto, il s'attelle à ce qui est probablement l'œuvre la plus complexe de Nabokov, Ada ou l'Ardeur, et son livre Nabokov's Ada, The Place of Consciousness, en 1985, ainsi que le site internet que vous pouvez consulter, qu'il a créé, Ada Online, en détaille, ligne après ligne, les codes, les allusions. Invité par Vera Nabokov, la veuve de l'écrivain, à cataloguer les archives de son mari, il en édite une biographie en deux volumes, très vite suivie de plusieurs ouvrages sur Pale Fire et les autres écrits et nouvelles de Vladimir Nabokov. Il participe également comme consultant à l'édition du manuscrit récemment paru sous le titre L'original de Laura, et c'est donc au titre de grand spécialiste de Nabokov qu'il nous parlera la semaine prochaine, mardi prochain, à 14h30, sous le titre Nabokov as Psychologist. Mais aujourd'hui, Brian Boyd va nous parler d'un autre livre qu'il vient de publier chez Harvard University Press en 2009, à l'occasion du bicentenaire de la naissance de Darwin, et qui s'intitule, et vous reconnaîtrez peut-être le titre, « On the Origin of Stories, Evolution, Cognition and Fiction ». Dans cet ouvrage, à travers une analyse serrée des mécanismes de l'évolution par sélection naturelle et de leur impact sur l'organisation cognitive humaine, il tente de proposer une interprétation darwinienne de la propension humaine pour l'art, et en particulier pour la fiction et pour le roman, avec une analyse notamment extrêmement intéressante de l'Odyssée et des épisodes de l'Odyssée, une analyse cognitive de l'Odyssée, si je puis dire. Alors, par les liens croisés qu'elle tisse entre les sciences cognitives et la littérature, cette œuvre de Brian Boyd m'a paru extrêmement stimulante et représentait quelque part un exemple et peut-être le meilleur de ce que pourrait devenir la fameuse consilience que le biologiste E.O. Wilson appelle de ses voeux, c'est-à-dire la synthèse harmonieuse des humanités avec les sciences de l'homme et de la nature. La considération simultanée des mécanismes cognitifs universels à l'œuvre dans tous les cerveaux humains et de la singularité des œuvres artistiques ancrées dans l'histoire, et bien entendu la personnalité d'un auteur, et le talent d'un auteur particulier. Je vous remercie donc, après cette introduction, de m'aider à accueillir Brian Boyd pour nous parler aujourd'hui de The Evolution of Stories.
Thank you very much, Stanislas, for that generous introduction. And it's a great pleasure to be in Paris again and to be speaking here for the first time, and a great honor to be speaking at the Collège de France. When did you last immerse yourself in the pool of make-believe? In a television drama or a film watched from the sofa or a cinema seat? A story you just read to your children? The comic strip you read in this morning's newspaper, a joke you heard at work or around the table, the novel you read last night, a love song on your iPod. Chances are the last fictional story you encountered was not long ago, and the previous one not long before that. Why do we spend so much of our time in story worlds, from pretend play and fairy tales to novels, TV sitcoms and vampire series, movies from Hollywood to Bollywood and art house or arte, and the stories in poems, song lyrics, and computer games. Wouldn't you expect a successful species, as we seem to be, to spend its time focusing on what's true in the world? Why does a species that derives so many of its advantages from mastering information have a compulsion to spend time engaged in fiction, distracting ourselves with what we know to be untrue? I teach literature, and fiction beats at the heart of literature. I don't want to take fiction for granted, even if it gives us such pleasure. We also get pleasure from ice cream and fresh butter. Explaining why we enjoy such treats by answering because they're delicious only takes us around in circles. Dung beetles find delicious the smell and taste of dung. We need to explain why we find pleasing the pleasures we happen to have. To a dung beetle or to any species we know but our own, our taste for stories would be perverse. In 1859, in On the Origin of Species, Darwin explained the variety of life on Earth in terms of natural selection. His explanation has been confirmed and deepened in ways even he could never have anticipated. In a world of finite resources, nature selects relentlessly over the generations in favour of those variations that offer some advantage, however small, in terms of survival and reproduction. Over time, those variations become established as adaptations, as bodily or behavioural features entrenched in the species because of the advantages that they offer for survival or reproduction. Natural selection selects stringently, weighing benefits against costs. Storytelling is comparatively cheap, except that it takes time and a little energy to invent, tell, and listen to stories. But we could use that time for activities with immediate biological advantage, like gathering resources or competing with others for resources already stockpiled. The evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins notes that if building dams were not beneficial to beavers, beavers with less inclination to pursue such a useless activity would have outbred those who wasted energy this way. But since dam building persists, it must offer beavers benefits. In the same way, if fiction offered no benefits in terms of reproductive success, those of us with less inclination to engage in it would thrive, and fiction would fade away as a human behaviour. Manifestly, it has not. So what benefits does it offer? Before I answer that, let me allay some fears. Some people do not want to consider applying evolution to human nature and behaviour, even if they recognise that we have to draw on evolution to explain everything else about life on Earth. I've answered such misgivings at length elsewhere, but let me just say this. Those who assume evolution must be irrelevant to human minds generally fear that it must suggest that our minds are fixed by our evolutionary past. But this is far from being the case. Evolution has shaped us to be flexible, to be ultra-social, to be ultra-cultural. The fear that evolution means fixed in old ways reflects the false old oppositions of biology versus culture or nature versus nurture. Oops. Culture, in fact, is not opposed to biology, but part of it. Culture just doesn't exist outside biological organisms. There are no rocks or rivers with culture. And it doesn't exist only in humans. There are traditions, dialects, and fashions in three distinct mammal and bird lineages. And we should think in terms, not in terms of nature versus nurture, but as the title of Matt Ridley's book suggests, nature via nurture. Genes are expressed only through their interaction with their environment. And as Ridley says, we can actually see genes as ways of extracting information from the environment. I'll make a case for art and fiction as evolved dispositions in the human mind, and that case depends very much on the mind's plasticity, its ability to be reshaped through repeat, focused engagement with art in general, and fiction in particular. Natural selection evolved humans to have life histories and minds that make us hyper-responsive to other humans, and therefore to our local culture, and also, I'll argue, to the honing of our key senses and our key intelligence through the arts, including fiction. Evolution pre-shaped our minds to be particularly reshapable by human experience, including the experience of art. Humans evolved to be longer lived, to learn more. Even in hunter-gatherer society, men do not become experts until they reach the age of about 40. So what hope do you have in a knowledge society like ours? Humans start off less fully formed at birth and remain dependent on others for longer and take longer to mature. Although we end up with the largest brains in relation to body size of any mammals, our brains at birth are much less than full size and develop under the care of others so that they can be flexibly fine-tuned as they develop. And our uniquely intense sociality has made stories one of our most compulsive ways of reshaping our minds, our most inviting gateway to the imagination. Even if you haven't any misgivings about evolution as applied to human minds and behaviour, you might well think that the kind of people who ask the question is storytelling and evolved adaptation are probably so impressed by the power of evolution that they'll be likely to conclude that, yes, storytelling is adaptive. But that's not quite true. As someone who teaches and loves literature, I'm interested in both its main strands, narrative and verse. These two strands often intertwine, sometimes tightly in the Iliad, the Divine Comedy, or Eugene Onegin, sometimes loosely in Hamlet, for instance, part verse, part prose, or almost not at all, as in Shakespeare's sonnets, all verse but without the sequence of narrative. But in the book I've just finished, On the Absence of Stories, Evolution, Cognition, and Lyric Verse, I conclude that although verse, like storytelling, exists across cultures, it is not an adaptation, but rather purely a cultural invention that has become universal across cultures, because it fits constraints of the human mind. Back to fiction now. It's no puzzle at all why we tell true stories. If we can comprehend events, and if we have language, and if we're highly social animals, then without needing to add anything else, we will tell true stories. Chimpanzees monitor each other intensely, and one chimp will even bring to the attention of another the fact that this male and that female are copulating behind that tree. Biologists see humans as not just social like chimps, but as uniquely ultra-social. We have even more reason than chimps to want to know who's doing what to whom. And with true narrative, we can also point out who has done you-know-what to whom, or who has done this or that successfully, and where and how. But in a world of unsparing biological competition, how could a successful species afford an unflagging appetite for stories we know to be untrue? To answer that, I think we have to explain why we expend time and resources across cultures, epochs, classes, life stages, and intellectual levels on the arts in all their forms, music, dance, design, and stories. I say this because it seems highly likely that the literary arts were the last of the arts to emerge. Analogues of music and dance exist in many species, in birds, in intelligent non-primates like whales and dolphins, and in primates like gibbons and chimpanzees. Chanting and rhythmic movement, and perhaps rhythmic stick or rock banging, in other words, forms of proto-song, proto-dance, and proto-drumming, seem to stretch back millions of years. And the earliest sign of the visual arts in hominins date back hundreds of thousands of years. Many Acheulean hand axes, which date from over 1.5 million to 100,000 years ago, have been found in impractical sizes, too large or too small to be used, or with an unnecessary degree of symmetry, and without, in these particular large or small cases, or these oversymmetrical ones, without the usual microscopic signs of wear and tear, as if they've been painstakingly shaped for purely ornamental reasons. Ochre seems to have been mined for human bodily adornment for perhaps 240,000 years. Although the matter is still being decided, a full modern language adequate for telling stories seems to date back only 100,000 years ago, or perhaps half as long again. Other proto-arts had probably been developing for hundreds of thousands of years before the first full-scale fictions. Why did the arts become established across human cultures and life stages? In On the Origin of Stories, I try to offer a comprehensive explanation for the arts, especially the art of fiction. Art, I argue, is a kind of high play. Play occurs in all mammals where it's been looked for. These are rats. Rats love to play. Jak Panczep, who works most with the cognitive functions of rats, says that he can play, he loves his rats, he can tickle them for half an hour and they'll still want more. They emit a little high-pitched squeal that we can't hear that seems analogous with human laughter. So play has been found in all mammals where it's been looked for, in birds and even in octopi, the most intelligent of invertebrates. For good evolutionary reasons, animals normally try to exert the least effort to accomplish their goals. Animals conserve resources, except in play, where they and we happily expend energy. Why? The amount of play in species correlates with its flexibility of behaviour. Flexibility of behaviour solves the problem of coping with unpredictable, complex circumstances. So, by definition, it cannot be entirely genetically programmed. A flexible behaviour has to be learned to maximise flexibility. If a behaviour is hardwired, there would be no point in exercising it in a way as expensive in energy and risk as play. But if there is room for flexibility, then individuals who can improve their execution of complicated behaviours and their judgment of situations in which they're needed will fare better. This is especially the case for critical behaviours such as flight or fight. If in secure situations animals practice the behaviours that make the greatest life and death difference, they can then perform better and with more context sensitivity in moments of high urgency. Recent work on brain plasticity shows that brains can be rewired incrementally through repeated activity, so long as it engages full attention. For that reason, play has developed in many species, especially those like birds and mammals that enjoy the security that parental care provides. Over generations, the motivation to practice has evolved and strengthened until play becomes compulsive, self-rewarding, irresistible. And the forms of play most popular in other animals and even ourselves are chasing or racing, flight, in other words, in terms of survival behaviours, and rough and tumble or wrestling, play fighting. And because we have the longest childhood of any species, play is particularly important for us. And because we now can produce food surpluses and live in settlements safe from predation, children have still more scope for play than the young of any other undomesticated animals. We humans uniquely gain most of our advantages over other species and even over one another, not from physical, but from mental strength and speed. We're alone in our cognitive niche. Information matters for any species, but for no others is it so decisive as for ours. Minds can process information rapidly to make the kind of real-time inferences that can guide action only when information falls into patterns for which those kinds of animals' minds have been prepared. Detecting pattern within information enables minds to understand their environment efficiently. Some of you will be familiar with this image, but until you see the pattern in it, it really looks rather meaningless. It is a Dalmatian dog, in case you hadn't guessed. That's the snout, its ears, and its legs there, so on. Once we see the pattern, it'll make sense. Until then, it's just a blur of dots. When recording devices track acoustic frequencies to analyze speech sounds objectively, they show continuous variation between distinct but related phonemes, B and P, for instance, and continuous sound production across what we hear as syllable or even word breaks. Yet even infants, even children not yet born, filter out the information or noise that tape recorders cannot help registering and begin to extract the patterns of phonemic distinctions in the language of their birth environment. Or take the patterns in human faces. We recognize individual faces, even if we see them from different distances and angles and with different expressions, as patterns that we could not express in words. And we can recognize some faces even after they've aged for decades since we last saw them. Experiments show that our facial muscles react to an emotionally expressive human face flashed on a screen too fast for conscious awareness. So our faces automatically adjust to some degree to the emotions that we haven't even recognized we've seen. All animals seem to prefer patterned information over more chaotic information arrays, especially the particular kinds of patterns that can yield rapid, rich inferences for their species. Because we particularly crave information, because we have a much more open-ended curiosity than other animals, we have a wide and intense appetite for pattern, for clear information, crisp outlines, bold colours, clear-pitched sounds. We therefore find beauty in flowers or butterflies, paintings or photographs, birdsong or music. We find pattern beautiful even in things we don't recognize, like images of electron flow. That's that one there. And that's a knotweed pollen. That's light diffraction at a crystalline level, and so on. Unlike other animals, therefore, we not only chase and tussle, we not only play physically, but we also play cognitively. Art, I suggest, is open-ended cognitive play with pattern, with patterns of intersecting pattern in the information modes that matter mostly to us. Sight in the visual arts, sound, especially in music, and in our ultra-social species, social information in fiction. In the social world, we see patterns of identity, who are they, personality and role, what are they like, what do they do, society, who are they related to, who do they team up with, how do they rank. In the world of events, we see patterns of cause and effect. In the world of social events, we see patterns of intention, action, and outcome. Let me take another path to the same end point. New evolutionary solutions themselves often spawn new problems, like any new solution. When our brains, our weapons, and our cooperative hunting techniques allowed us to become super predators, to dominate our environments and earn the food that we needed in much less time than our waking hours, we did not solve the problem of spare time like other top predators, lions, tigers, or bears, by sleeping the extra hours away to conserve energy. Even at rest, our large brains consume a high proportion of our energy, and since they offer us most of our advantages against other species and other individuals, we benefit not from resting them as much as possible, but from developing them as much as possible in times of security and leisure. But we don't naturally do what might be good for us in future unless we enjoy it now. Art as cognitive play appealing to our appetite for potentially meaningful patterned information, engages our minds in a self-rewarding and therefore self-motivating way, compulsive, high intensity, swift changing, and often repeated, like all play. Minds, as recent neuroscience has discovered, can be plastic, they can be reshaped, but not easily or rapidly, as we know, say, from learning a new language later in life. It takes much repetition and focused attention, as first some new neural connections are made, then more on top of those, still more on top of those. As the most successful connections strengthen, mental processing becomes more efficient until the whole network is established and increasingly efficiently tuned and fast-tracked. Play can reshape minds to become more efficient and flexible in particular kinds of response because it is compulsively self-rewarding. We take part in it again and again, our minds fully focused. So too with the uniquely human cognitive play of art, including the art of fiction. The compulsiveness of music, images, and story reshapes human minds, just as physical play shapes animal bodies and minds. Research suggests, writes Melvin Connor in his magisterial The Evolution of Childhood, which came out last year, that in positive and playful moods, we are more open to experience and learn in better and more varied ways. We process oral, visual, and social information more accurately, rapidly, and flexibly through playing in a self-rewarding way with the high-density information patterns of art. Without instruction or prompting, children engage eagerly in song, dance, drawing, or shape-making. They adore pretend play and want stories told again and again. Other functions build on this start for art in cognitive fine-tuning, and especially on fiction as cognitive play with patterns of social information. Not only does their compulsiveness improve our social cognition, but also individuals who can earn the attention of others through art gain in status. Reshaping minds, as I've said, requires focused attention, yet minds evolved to monitor the immediate environment, not the infinite space of the possible or the real or the unreal. To compete for attention with the real and the immediate, storytellers tend to offer high-intensity information with striking characters, often with unusual powers, facing high stakes in extreme situations. Even a bright four-year-old concocting his own story knows how to hook and hold his own attention and that of listeners. Let me read this wonderful four-year-old story. Once there was a dragon who went poo-poo on a house, and the house broke. Then when the house broke, the people died. And when the people died, their bones came out and broke and got together again and turned into a skeleton. And then the skeletons came along and scared the people out of that town. And then when all the people got scared out of the town, then skeleton babies were born. And then everyone called it Skeleton Town. And when they called it Skeleton Town, the people came back, and then they got scared away again. And then when they all got scared away again, the skeletons died. No one came to the town, so there was no people ever in that town ever again. This boy's social cognition has not yet become sophisticated enough to incorporate intention into his story, yet he already perfectly understands attention, as of course do mothers telling fairy tales or professional storytellers aiming at their larger audiences. Fiction helps extend our imaginations. It takes minds that first evolved to deal with the here and now away from the here and now so that we can see from multiple perspectives in time, place, person, and mode. Most who consider the emergence of higher intelligence accept that the main pressure on advanced intelligence has been social, because other agents can make the most regular, most rapid difference to one's own fitness as predators or prey, enemies or allies, mates or rivals. The most sophisticated systems built into the human brain are therefore those for understanding agents, any creature who can act, animals, humans, and even by extension, unseen agents like spirits. In ancient environments, the agents we evolved to track were other animals as well as people. And even in modern urban environments, children have a compulsive desire to learn the names of animals and to play or attend to stories with animals in them. Our minds want to and easily can track and differentiate agents, since other agents, human or not, offer the most complex, volatile, and high-stake information that we regularly encounter. We carry that motivation and capacity into pretend play and story. Minds evolved naturally to focus on the here and now, and very young children don't readily think offline, away from the here and now. They don't even easily recall their own recent past, but they can easily use the present props of toys or a stick or a rag that can be an animal or a baby, or the modern handmade or manufactured toy to conjure up scenarios involving agents that hook their attention. My youngest granddaughter said her first word at 10 months old, Angela, the name of the doll that her mother too had as a child. We learn to think in sustained fashion in ways decoupled from the here and now, first by using physical props as fellow agents, then gradually by using the ready-made stories and characters of our culture. By building on our appetite for social information, fiction stretches our imaginations, taking us from here, the here and now, along tracks that we can easily follow because they're the fresh tracks of agents. Stories offer a laboratory space for social thought experiments, tested on our emotions and on our understanding of human nature. From pretend play to completely offline fictions, we try out new possibilities and roles, testing social options and social emotions. The compulsiveness of story helps us to improve our skills of switching perspectives, of seeing from other points of view, of imagining alternative or counterfactual scenarios. As the psychologist and novelist Keith Oatley and his colleagues remark, fiction works as a social simulator, allowing us to stretch our scope beyond the actual to the possible or the impossible. We need not be confined to the given, but we can turn actuality around within the much larger space of possibility to explain how things are or to see how they could have been or might be. We need not explicitly remember scenarios because fiction as simulator, like other forms of practice, works via implicit even more than by explicit memory. Recent work by Oatley and his former students Raymond Maher and Maya Jikic powerfully supports the claims that I had to make on the origin of stories on the basis of triangulating from evolutionary considerations and from other empirical work on play, brain plasticity and mental reconfiguration in one art that's the most precisely studied in the brain, music. They've worked especially on fiction and the effects it has on social cognition. They show that exposure to narrative fiction, a lifetime preference for reading fiction, was positively associated with empathic ability, whereas exposure to non-fiction, a lifetime preference for reading non-fiction, was negatively associated with empathy. To confirm that it's not merely people with better social cognition preferring to read fiction, while those with poorer social cognition prefer to read non-fiction, they experimented with the material of Chekhov's story, The Lady with the Little Dog. They compared groups that read the story as written by Chekhov, translated, and groups that read the same material in the form of a court report, a divorce court report, which was independently rated just as high on interest as the story, rather to my surprise. Personality trait change for participants in the art condition in reading the story was significantly greater, they report, than the change for participants in the control condition, suggesting that, in my terms, the cognitive play of fiction lures readers to simulate the experience of the characters to a greater degree than the non-play of factual narrative. Emotional attunement in cognitively appealing forms improves social cohesion as does the creation of engaging pro-social models. Any gain in the ability to attune one's feelings to others and to motivate attunement can increase cohesion and cooperation, and therefore offer a competitive advantage against other groups that cohere less well. Think of things like work songs, battle songs, anthems, hymns, parables, heroic stories. As William Flesch shows in his book Comeuppance, much of the emotion generated by story, the fear, the hope, the suspense, comes from our anxiety over whether the characters, good and bad, will get what they deserve. John Gottschall rightly takes that one step further in his forthcoming book, Story Minds. Not only does fiction reflect an instinctive human morality, a pro-social impulse, but it also reinforces it. In a series of papers, Gottschall and his colleagues proposed that stories make societies work better by encouraging us to be more like pro-social protagonists and less like the would-be domineering antagonists. Like the other arts, fiction becomes a kind of high play that also offers a sense of human mastery, a sense that we can shape the world on our own terms. Homer, the greatest of early storytellers, unfolds the world as humanly knowable, from the minds of the gods to the minds of humans, from the panorama of the known world down to a detail like the latch on a door. Homer's stories, classicists have argued, may even have provided the incentive to develop the first alphabet. They certainly provided the core of Greek education and arguably the confidence in the mind's capacity to encompass the world that inspired Greek thought. This takes us into another aspect of the power of stories and their effect on the imagination. Imagination of the simplest sort seems to have evolved to help animals to propose to themselves alternative scenarios for possible action. In most animals with rudiments of imagination, such scenarios presumably involve only imminent possible actions, but partly through story, human imaginations stretch far further. That expansion of imagination through brain growth, through play, art, story, language, culture, has made complex long-term strategizing possible, but it has also had the consequence that our minds can run through a host of possible remote scenarios, including many swarming with threats, dangers, mishaps. After all, our emotional systems are more loaded toward the negative than the positive, since negative impacts can make a more drastic, sudden difference to our fitness than positive changes. Superstitious and religious attempts to ward off foreglimpsed dangers testify across cultures to the vivid force of human apprehension. As our imaginations have expanded, we've also become adept at meta-representation, at entertaining multiple perspectives and understanding the relationship of one perspective to another, like that of successive moments of our past to each other and to the present or the future, or others' perspectives on us or on anything else. Our capacity to understand other perspectives so well allows us to understand false belief. We appreciate clearly that others may not know information relevant to the situation that we happen to know. But that also means that we can realize that we may not know what we need to know, and that realization drives human curiosity. But it also drives our unique human anxiety. There may be things we feel we need to know about that we know we don't know. That shapes stories, dramatic irony, what some of us know about a situation that others do not. Our imaginative capacity has especially made it impossible for us not to consider the world after our own death. Whatever apprehension we have about life, we know that we'll face a death we probably can't control, and that once dead, we will no longer be able to exert any control. Our bodies will be helplessly subject to whatever forces happen to act on them. Imagination offers us huge benefits, but at our full human level, it also exacts a huge cost. If we can imagine other times and perspectives and possibilities, we can also imagine our own deaths, our absence from the ongoing life that we now lead, our physical inertness and decomposition, the possibility of our spiritual non-existence or a permanent prolongation of the pain and grief associated with dying, or worse. Because our imaginations naturally play with agents, we have ways to fill the cracks in our knowledge and to allay our anxieties. We have a natural tendency to overread rather than to underread agency. Better to suppose that that bush is a bear or that shadow is a snake than vice versa. We want to do things, and we do. We see agency as the prototype of cause. We're fascinated by powers different from ours, animals more powerful than us, birds that fly by day, owls or bats that fly by night and see in the dark. Throughout history, our predisposition to think in terms of agency has allayed our anxiety and seemed to settle our uncertainty through a kind of social confabulation. We prefer to confabulate, to fill in gaps with the imagined stories rather than confront our failure to understand. We cope with our anxiety about not knowing enough by inventing stories involving agents who know what we don't. As research shows, we especially notice and remember creatures with powers that are minimally counterintuitive. In other words, for example, gods or spirits who can see but remain unseen, rather than, say, gods who exist only on Wednesday afternoons. Stories of this kind pervade all known cultures, and the sense of control that they help give human lives mean that they've been handed down through generations in compelling stories, often reinforced by compelling ritual, music, dance, costume, and architecture. For a long time, much of the power of art and story has been commandeered by religion. So the species that thrives most on information also generates the acknowledged fictions of stories and the apparent explanations in the stories that have congealed into belief, into religion. Although true information may be invaluable biologically, if I want to kill prey, I need to know where it is, information need not invariably be true to be biologically advantageous. So long as it leads to biologically advantageous behavior, it can be favored. A belief, say, in an unseen being who will punish uncooperative conduct, even if others in my group cannot see some of this behavior, may benefit the cohesiveness of my group and therefore our capacity to overcome competing groups. Religion offers explanations beyond what we can see. It allays our anxieties about what we recognize we don't know, and it does so via our inclination to understand in terms of agency so natural for our ultrasocial species. Eventually, our awareness that there are things we don't know and should find out leads to science, to explaining things without agency. Science, too, uses our ultrasociality, although in a different way, through the competitive and cooperative advancing and testing of ideas. But whereas agency comes naturally to us, systematically challenging and testing the ideas that seemed to have allowed us to survive so far seems comparatively unnatural. Unlike stories with agents, which we've evolved to be predisposed to, the agentless explanations of scientific stories seem unnatural and emotionally demanding and requiring us to put our best explanations to the test, and imaginatively draining and requiring us to think about mechanisms not at the level of agency. The account of art, and especially of fiction, that I've proposed involves no unique morphological traits, although of course I'd be fascinated and delighted if they were discovered. In the case of fiction, I assume that we'd already developed both systems of event comprehension, like the psychological capacities known as theory of mind, understanding others in terms of not just actions, but also in terms of intentions, desires, and beliefs, that make it possible for us to track the full complexity of social events and the capacity for language that makes it possible to communicate events. But our predilection for art, and especially the art of fiction, involve motivational traits. Humans have the same compulsion as other animals to play at physical activities and like them too, especially at activities associated with flight and fight. Children, especially boys, also have a special motivation cross-culturally to throw stones, sticks, balls, darts, frisbees, fruit, snowballs, and much more, presumably in reflection of a developmental preparation for our unique human tendency in the past to use projectiles for attack and defence. Well, we still do, in motorised projectiles. In the same way, we extend ordinary animal play into our play with patterned information in preparation for our unique tendency to use information for attack, defence, and everything else. Few filmmakers have produced such searing explanations of the explorations of the human condition as Ingmar Bergman, but he described filmmaking as like returning to childhood, a game, a kind of play. The Nobel Prize-winning Turkish novelist Orhan Pamuk writes for 10 hours a day. "Yes, I'm a hard worker. I'm in love with what I do. I enjoy sitting at my desk like a child playing with his toys. It's work, essentially, but it's fun and games also." He was going to be a painter, and there you can see his manuscript doodles on the right as he's doing the hard work of writing. I've been explaining fiction as a late emerging art, and art needs to be one leg of a well-balanced exploration of fiction. The other leg is narrative, a behaviour related to but also moving radically beyond other animal understanding, communication and play. We can see the origins of our capacities for understanding events in related species and especially in the uniquely human levels of theory of mind. We can trace how the unique human capacity for reporting events emerges from animal capacities for representing events, but adds new capacities for joint attention, imitation, and language. And we can see the unique human practice of inventing events, a form of cognitive play with patterns of social information, especially in terms of the emergence of pretend play in human infancy. Stories, factual and fictional, raise many questions for art in general and literature in particular, and for psychology and neuroscience, beyond the question whether fiction is adaptive. How central and perhaps how enabling or how constricting is our tendency to think in narrative terms? We see the power of narrative not only in acknowledged fictions, but also in dreams, night story, if you like. We can see it in confabulation, the mind's tendency to make a plausible story to explain what we're doing when we don't actually know. The neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga, who's worked more than anyone else on confabulation in split brain patients, calls the left hemisphere of the brain the interpreter because of its rushing in to offer a narrative interpretation of what we see and do. The evolutionary literary critic John Gottschall calls the left brain simply the story mind. We see the power of narrative in schizophrenia and other forms of psychosis that deploy the narrative inclinations of the mind to construct elaborate, unfounded stories. We see something similar even in the psychologically normal, whether from the left or right of the political spectrum, when they engage in conspiracy theories. We see the power of narrative in memory when it turns out to be actively constructive rather than passively and accurately recorded, and vulnerable to suggestion and self-serving rather than neutral. We see the power of narrative in religion and myth, which provide ways of understanding the world that make sense to most, not because they're true, but because they make good stories. Unlike evolution with its vast timescales, its incremental changes, its intersection of chance mutation and selective pressure, and its impersonal agency, or science in general, with its non-human scales in space and time, and its dethroning of agent-based explanations of the kind that are so natural to us. Unless I'm mistaken, we don't know how the understanding of events is instantiated in the brain. Perhaps you can say that you do know already, Stan. Nor how the understanding of narratives is instantiated there, nor how these two relate. In On the Origin of Stories, I suggested how much of our understanding of events probably overlaps with at least some other animals, because it emerges in human development before language, in what developmental psychologists call intuitive physics, our understanding of basic objects and forces, intuitive ontology, our understanding of natural and artificial kinds, intuitive psychology, our understanding of minds, our theory of mind, and perhaps also an intuitive sociology, an understanding of affiliation, alliance, and hierarchy. We understand and effortlessly track identity. We swiftly form personality trait impressions. We have a ready understanding of standard situations, scripts, or scenarios. We have episodic memories that retain the flavors of experience, especially of experience strongly colored by emotion, although the memories are usually compressed into gist, into summary form, that make it easier to connect one situation with others. Our memories, like our experiences, are multimodal, combining the senses, the motor areas of the brain, the emotions, language, and thought, so that they allow us to reactivate all those areas as we encounter the indirect experiences of narrative or the purely imagined experiences of fiction. As we mature, we focus more intently on goal-oriented information in stories and presumably in real-life situations, and we learn to move from local to global understanding. We know much more than we used to about stories and mind, but we have so much to learn about how the two connect. The neuroscientist Antonio Damasio proposes convergence zones in the brain, where, say, the separate where and what visual pathways converge to allow us to understand both the nature and the location of objects. And these feed in turn into higher level convergence zones where information from still more different kinds of pathways, like visual and oral and emotional, meet. Does narrative naturally arise from or require, or as it were, create a superconvergent zone? There appear to be even more feedback loops from higher information processing levels to lower ones than feed forward channels from lower ones to higher. Are some of these feedback loops top-down searches for narratively salient information? Do convergence or superconvergent zones often lead to false inferences? In the 1920s, the Russian filmmaker Lev Kuleshov famously shot Ivan Mozhukhin, intercut with a child in a coffin, a bowl of soup, and an attractive young woman. You can see them here all simultaneously, and you can see that the faces of Mozhukhin are exactly the same. But when this was projected sequentially, people thought, what an amazing actor. He's got this relatively still face, but he's experiencing such compassion for the child in the coffin, such hunger for the bowl of soup, such lust for the young woman. Do other animals have super convergent zones of a narrative kind? Do they understand events in a cause and effect way? Do they worry about not understanding causes behind effects as we do? Or does our apparently unique capacity to understand false belief, to understand how it's possible to be wrong about a situation from not knowing enough relevant information, mean that worrying about causes is uniquely human? How essential are pretend play and early story in developing the story mind, in our inclination and capacity to see experience in narrative terms? How essential is language in developing a narrative awareness? Do the facility for narrative comprehension and production develop in tandem in individuals, and do they co-evolve in our species? Can we work out the evolutionary, developmental, and neurocognitive relationships between the capacities for episodic memory, for joint attention, for emotional attunement with others, for miming, for language, for fully narrative dreaming, for... For mental time travel, for understanding false belief, and for imaginative embodied reconstructions of another's narrative, for inferring the intentions of others and actors and storytellers. And what are the relations between these and the predispositions for pretend play, for confabulation, for social and scientific and existential and metaphysical and religious narration? Well, after spending an exhilarating, stimulating day yesterday with Professor Dan, I have one more slide, one more question, one more conjecture. Is the default task orientation of the human mind narrative? The first task of the simplest motile organism seems to be understanding their own spatial situation, and that's still our first task when we come back to consciousness after some lapse, after simply falling asleep or being anaesthetized or whatever. The next kind of task, for more complex animals, seems to be understanding the different objects and agents around them and their affordances, what kind of opportunities or risks these other objects or agents pose. A still more complex highest default state that seems to be added in highly social animals like chimpanzees is understanding the dispositions and attitudes and intentions of those around them in their own species. And in the human case, although our minds can go further with training, the default top state of information processing, the mental station or workspace to which information is shunted if it's possible to process it further, is perhaps understanding the temporal situation we're in, understanding the causes of the current situation so that we can better predict the possible continuations. Is this, for us, the default orienting task of the mind, our default task assignment? Well, I've tried to answer and ask what questions I can. The rest I leave up to you. Thank you for your attention.